this time I won't drop it. There's something I wanted to start with that I hadn't planned on, but while I'm up here, I don't get this opportunity very often, so I really, really want to thank our worship team. I don't think they get enough credit for all they do. We have great singers, great instruments, great service every week, and I thank them for that. There's a lot of work goes into it. Thank you. One other thing I want to say. First of all, I really appreciate the video and the comments on Memorial Day. As you know, I'm a veteran. One of the lines in the video really caught my attention. Not all of them die on the battlefield. I've had one of my section soldiers and one of my co-workers both die of suicide. Veteran suicide is a real thing. And it's hard. Okay. Let's start with a prayer. Lord, open our eyes and our ears that we would see and hear these different worldviews. Open our hearts and minds that through them we would understand ourselves and others better. I pray, Lord, that as we gain this understanding, we would use it to increase our awareness of the pieces of worldviews that we've adopted. We'd be able to shed them, have a thirst to know, understand, and grow your word, and grow into the only worldview that matters, the biblical Christian worldview, the worldview that's according to you. Thank you. In the name of Jesus, amen. You know, it's an honor to talk to y'all today, and yeah, I'm a bit nervous, but really my biggest concern today, other than having a dry mouth, is being able to impart to you what knowing about and understanding the worldviews means to your life, in your life, and what it means to, the life of your children and the life of others. Before the series started, Michael had given the leader team the book, Hidden Worldviews, Eight Cultural Stories That Shape Our Lives. And I did get around to reading it, actually. And I had to use a lot of it, of course, for this lesson I'm doing today. And some of them, you know, kind of applied, and you think about them and everything. But there's two of them that really struck me. And part of it was because I felt like it was so today. And that was the one that Michael did last week with moral relativism, and the one we're going to do this week, which has a big fancy name of postmodern tribalism, which I'll get into in a little bit. It impacted me, the book impacted me, and those two impacted me because of this. It's like, why didn't I know this? And this is something we really need to know and understand as Christians. So, what's the goal of this series on worldviews? One is the need for us to recognize the contrast between secular worldviews and biblical worldviews. Michael started with the secular worldviews, so we're aware and understand we've assimilated parts of them throughout our life. We need to see them in our own lives. Then, and only then, are we going to be able to see them in the culture and the people around us. We need to know how these worldviews affect our lives and the lives of others. Further, when we're talking to somebody about capital T, ultimate, universal truth and logic, and yet they're speaking in emotions and feelings and my truth is the truth, we're speaking different languages. When we understand what pieces of secular worldviews we've absorbed, and then learn about the biblical Christian worldview, which we'll do here in a couple weeks, we can better see how we need to apply and live it in our lives. And guess what? We may realize we've got some fixing and changing to do. The definition of worldview we've been using, and you've heard it, I think, every week, is this. A worldview is a commitment, a fundamental orientation of the heart, that can be expressed as a story or a set of presuppositions, assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false, which we hold consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic constitution of reality and that provides a foundation on which we live and move and have our being.
Wow.
That's a lot of words.
Yeah.
That's a lot of words. I think I've heard that every week now, and I still have trouble with it. So I'm going to try to do a visual. I don't have a slide up here, so we'll do a word picture. How's that? We've all heard of rose-colored glasses, right? A worldview is like putting on those rose-colored glasses. Everything you see comes up roses. Life is wonderful and bright. It's like if the opposite would be putting on dark sunglasses at night. You wouldn't have a clue. Some people do walk around like that, by the way. There's another visual I came up with, which is it's probably a little weird, but we'll go there anyway. So think about making macaroni. Once it's done, you pour it into a colander, and that colander is a filter. So if you pour it in there, all the water comes out. And in the bottom, you know, your water, you have Water World. Oh, guys, somebody probably didn't remember that movie. So on the other side of the colander, the filter, you have pasta land. Yeah? Now, if you're in Water World, looking through that filter, the little holes, and you see a bunch of macaroni, you really don't understand it. And if you're the macaroni, looking through those little holes, you're not going to really understand Water World. Because each one of those, your world is based in either macaroni or the Water World. That's what you really understand. You may not even understand the other side. So let's do a review of the worldviews we've covered so far. The very first week, Michael did individualism. It's all about me. I'm the center of the universe, large and in charge, ruler of my life, and, don't forget this, the God of my life. Week two was consumerism, which we're probably all familiar with in some ways. Michael showed us through Genesis how God created us as consumers, but with boundaries. We're free to consume because God telling Adam and Eve they could eat the fruit of any tree in the garden. And the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which they weren't supposed to eat of, that's the boundary. Solomon, a guy who should know, says in Proverbs chapter 18, verse 11, the rich think of their wealth as an impregnable defense. They imagine it is a high wall of safety. So, that all sounds familiar to you. And consumerism really means the things we can't take with us, whether money or possessions, become our security, what satisfies our soul, rather than relying on God. On week three, Michael did his lesson on nationalism, and that's actually a tough one to do. I can understand that. Personally, I'm glad it was not Michael and not me. It's about patriotism, being proud of your country. It's a good thing to have both of those things. But what the problem is when government replaces God as a solution to all of life's ills. That's where the real problem lies. And if you want an example of that, just go through 20th century history. There's a couple of great examples in there. And then in week four, John Burton, our biology teacher extraordinaire, thank you, John, took us on a journey through scientific naturalism. He showed us how it's been around for almost 200 years and really took off thanks to Charles Darwin and The Origin of the Species. And I'll bet you every person in this room has heard that book. Yeah. Scientific naturalism can be summed up as only matter matters. We got this. We don't need God. There's no spiritual. None. Not a man. And then last week, Michael spoke on moral relativism. He asked, if we went back 20 years, 50 years, would morality be the same? Relativism theory denies that humans can possess objective truth, universally meaningful knowledge, or unchanging moral absolutes. You be you. Every individual's morality is what matters. Michael made great points in showing issues that moral relativism brings upon itself, both logically and in society. And by the way, for next week, which is week seven, Michael will be tackling salvation by therapy. And just so you know, there's no misunderstanding, it is not a condemnation of therapy. So I want to get that out of the way right away. But he's going to be talking about salvation by therapy. As for myself, I found tribalism foreign to my way of thinking. Just as I found this week's postmodern tribalism worldview foreign to my way of thinking. I was asking, what does that even mean? What kind of a world is postmodern tribalism? And that's a good question. It's two different but connected worldviews. And we're going to examine the path from worldview of modernism to that of postmodernism, and then to tribalism. So, woohoo, more worldviews, and toss in some social constructs, please. So, next slide, Captain. Should be the one that's the path. So, there we go. Thank you. So, my goal is, with this funny-looking diagram you're seeing, is to help keep your sanity. I had to read this a number of times to try to get an idea of what was happening. And the real thing is in order to know what postmodernism means, we've got to know what modernism is. And so we're going to have to go through that worldview. At the root of modernism, the worldview was a search for absolute certainty and universal truth. Modernists believed that each individual could arrive at this universal truth if biases were set aside and proper means of investigation, which were grounded in empirical observation and scientific method, were used. Once harnessed, this universal truth could be used to solve all our problems which result from untrue ideas. Any beliefs from tribal superstition, particular cultures, any beliefs that couldn't be confirmed through empirical observation, scientific methods, or logic, had to be rooted out and corrected by any means necessary, whether through proper education, marginalization, or conquering. That's because modernists believe that when universal truth is found and everybody knows and agrees on the universal truth, then all problems are solved. The world is a happy place, and we'll all sit around at Bensonburger singing happy songs. So, from this, you can probably gather the scientific naturalism that John talked about last week. That was an outshoot of modernism. In fact, the authors wrote, and that's why those three little arrows are up there, that without the worldview of modernism, the book Hidden Worldviews wouldn't have chapters on individualism, nationalism, or naturalism as they arose with and from modernism. So, when I read about modernism, it kind of struck a chord with me, quite honestly. Because modernism is the worldview I identify with. I realize that with the most, I identify with it the most. And I realize it's the worldview that I grew up in, it's that shaped my life. I really have a suspicion that most of the 40-somethings and over might also feel that way, because it's probably the kind of worldview you grew up with. And I'm confident it's why moral relativism and postmodern tribalism are hard for me to understand. One of the social constructs of modernism, which is up on the screen there, was the Great American Melting Pot. Immigrants to America assimilated into the culture, and within a few generations, their children and grandchildren were American in attitude, words, deed, with English as their only language. They didn't know their ancestral language. They were fully part of the American culture and not their ancestral culture. And it's interesting to me that I can remember actually discussing the Great American Melting Pot when I was in school in the early 60s. Because I dated myself. Anyway, the melting pot successfully transformed them from hyphenated Americans, Italian American, Irish American, Asian American, German American, to just plain Americans. However, people started wondering they had lost a significant something in this transition. And at the same time, some elders felt excluded from mainstream society. And That's what's going to bring us to this one, multiculturalism. It could be a worldview, I think, but I'm calling it a social construct because in my head it fit in better with this. Honestly, it was about the only way I could see it. I don't know that it lasted very long either. So, multiculturalism envisioned a nation where a person's cultural identities were maintained. Like a piece of tile with its unique features, shapes, and colors. As in the picture, when combined, these tiles merge into a coherent, multicolored piece of art. Rather than melting differences away, as in the Great Melting Pot, multiculturalism celebrated cultural variety with a broader unity. Okay, have you ever tried to say cultural multiple times? It's really hard. It's a tongue twister. So, multiculturalism would result in fundamental change in the way the United States had thought of itself for probably more than a century. That's one thing about modernism. Modernism runs quite a ways back in our history. It's been around a long time, probably close to 100 years or more. Think about when Darwin and stuff was done. Naturally, this caused friction with modernists. Some were seeing a burdensome quota system. Some thought it was very unpatriotic, or they weren't being grateful to American culture and opportunity. But those that were advocating for multiculturalism were seeing an opportunity. They were seeing an opportunity to right past wrongs. They were conjuring up positive visions of family tradition and a sense of belonging, those of the shared heritage. Again, multiculturalism, I won't have to say that too many more times, thankfully, envisioned the United States where our differences could be celebrated, and yet we are still united. Well, yes, there's a wrinkle, because as the author said, debate wasn't even resolved before new voices showed up at the party. So, now we're going to deal with postmodern tribalism. First thing we've got to talk about is postmodern. That collection of voices came from those who felt excluded from the power structures and ignored by multiculturalism. Some were ethnicity, others by factors like gender, age, sexual orientation, and disability. So now that I've described modernism, we can talk about postmodern. Why do they call it postmodern? Okay. I'm not a philosopher, okay? I never really liked philosophy anyway. And so the cynical side of me is, I say that it's called postmodern because of logical and descriptive anti-modernism doesn't roll off the tongue, doesn't sound as intellectual, it sounds more positive, and it might make it too easy to understand. Oh, and by the way, I kind of wish I wrote anti-modern tribalism on one of those two on the slide. So while modernism searches for absolute certainty, universal truth, and setting aside bias, postmodernism looks at the very idea of universal stories, truth, claims to absolute truth, and ideas of unbiased neutrality with disbelief. Now you can see why I say anti-modernism. They were opposed. So according to postmodern philosophers, this is one of the things they get out of this, is meta-narratives, or beyond narratives, if you've ever wondered what that was like I did, stories that have turned fiction, invented story, definitions, have lost their power to convince. They are literally stories that are told in order to legitimize various versions of the truth. And all religions, by the way, including the Christian story, is considered a meta-narrative, a fictional story. So, in part, postmodern's message is that all social structures, and listen to this, are essentially political in nature, and to put it bluntly, it's all about power. In tribalism, modernism's, the second half of that word there, modernism's universality acknowledges that human beings came in male and female, different races, ethnicities, genders, and cultures, but say that that does not determine one's humanness, their characteristics of being human. However, for the tribalism half of postmodern tribalism, humanness can't be separated from any other particular factor, whether gender, race, ethnicity, culture, or any other factor of our lives. Let that sink in. Instead, these are essential to our ideas of identity, morality, religion, and truth, leading to significant implications when emphasizing particular factors, race, creed, gender, etc., over universality. For example, truth isn't universal or absolute, but socially constructed and shaped by our gender, culture, race, abilities, sexual orientation, and I. One sense of well-being can't be measured by any universal standard, but it's determined by how well one is integrated into a tribe with its unique ideas of true, the good, and the beautiful. If this is the case, then the third implication is that marginalized groups must undermine the claims of dominant culture in order to get the social recognition and power that is due them. If everything is politics, political strategies, understood broadly, must be used to bring about a shift in the power structures. All right. But we know, we're Bible readers, right? We know that tribes have been around a long time. As a matter of fact, the Bible refers to tribe or tribes nearly 300 times, almost all of them in the Old Testament. First Testament. Like Genesis 49:28 says, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to him when he blessed them, giving each the blessing appropriate to him. It's full of tribes. It talks about them a lot. So, just like they have been for thousands of years, in one sense, tribes are around today. So, ready? You're going to have to think on this one. Think about the friends you hang out with. They may be from your church, or your life tribe, your bowling tribe, or maybe your crafting tribe, sewing tribe, right? That's what they're doing too. Sit down in the lunchroom, and you'll probably sit with your lunchroom tribe. Why? It's because you have a connection. You're comfortable with those people, and you feel safe with the people in that group. To this day, there's no denying we have a tribal urge. Everybody's heard of the words cliques, right? Oh, that clerk, that church, that congregation has so many cliques in it. Oh, those people over there are cliques. We want to be in a group where we can belong and others are excluded. The place where a person knows their place and exactly what's expected of them. People who will be there in their time of need, whether sick, sad, or some other need. Folks who will not let you die alone. And I can't help but think of Ruth. When she says, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you from me. What was Ruth doing there? She was separating herself from her old tribe, attaching herself to a new tribe. And by the way, those tribes, one Moab, one Israelite, had very different thoughts. So tribe members share a powerful sense of identity within a smaller group defined by a common language, by meaning, experiences, and ideas, by an awareness of competition with outsiders for scarce resources, and a feeling that the group is necessary for survival. You know, I mentioned earlier that there's good in all of these. Maybe I didn't. But there's good in all of these worldviews. Okay? So what's good about postmodern tribalism? Three of the worldviews we've covered so far, individualism, nationalism, and scientific naturalism, are derived from modernism, and actually they're hostile to Christianity. That should leave us with an understanding that modernism is a questionable intellectual home for Christianity. mean, for those who grow up in Myers, and we think it's basically since Swiss cheese, but got those. But it's actually not that great an intellectual home for us. So at least by his critique, postmodern tribalism offers us a useful appraisal of the problems of modernism. And yet, certain segments of American Christianity were really comfortable in the mainstream of American society. But life in the United States has changed. And now we're feeling outside of the normal social structures. We're feeling pushed out and want our Christian nation back. Yeah, I know that feeling. I'll confess it right here. I know that feeling. What we commonly do is gather with like people, our tribe. But in what seems like a more Christian response, this sense of marginalization could or should help us develop greater empathy for others that have been left out. We can have empathy because of postmodern tribalism. And Christians have struggled for centuries with balancing God's kingdom in our place in society. When Constantine gave Christianity a favored place in the Roman Empire, many trace the demise of the early church's spiritual vitality to it. Postmodernism views the world as competition for social power to advance the cause of one's own group. Do we Christians protect our share of power or pursue a uniquely Christian understanding of authority? That's a good question. So tribalism can help Christians recognize a dependence on alien to us definitions of power. And this is another interesting point. Too often Christians fall into the trap that limits sin to individuals. We talk about that a lot. However, sin has a history of getting ingrained in social structures. Economics made it difficult to get rid of slavery. Intellectual superiority perpetuated colonialism and sexism, and manifest destiny made it possible to dehumanize Native Americans in a drive to expand the country, with well-meaning and bright Christians participating because of deeply embedded social systems and tarnishing the reputation of Christianity while they were at it. Christianity has suffered as a result. So tribalism can help us recognize these wrongs and help Christians recognize the systematic aspect of sin. One of the greatest examples of that are the Israelites. You look in the Old Testament, you read about the Israelites, and you can see that systemic nature of sin. So there's many basic life functions that are a function of our culture. Forming families, educating children, governments, punishing lawbreakers, celebrating milestones, and more. All cultures do these kind of things. What we do is cross-cultural. How we do those is shaped by our culture. And they give us a sense of order, rhythm, a framework. And what we do seems normal to us, but can seem alien and wrong to other cultures. Do you remember when we were sending peanut butter over to the Middle East to help them eat? They didn't know what to do with it. I don't know if that's a great example, but it's one. Modernism's inclination was to see these deviations to be brought into conformity, while postmodern tribalism encourages the preservation of diversity, recognizing these practices give structure to life's fundamental functions. Postmodern tribalism preserves culture and provides a way of ordering life. That's the good stuff. But now we've got to cover the other side of it. Going up, okay? Cover the good stuff, we're going to cover the not so good stuff. Don't call it that. So what's not good about postmodern tribalism? Well, how we get along with people of different religions, races, lifestyles, and nationalities has become one of the pressing issues of our age. The interests of postmodern tribalism and Christianity merge in the desire for mutual respect between cultures and rejection of domination of marginalized groups by imperialistic power. But, Christians need to ask if postmodern tribalism has sufficient resources to actually reach out or even justify such goals. It says it wants all voices heard. But, do the assumptions of postmodern tribalism provide a basis for real communication? Will they advocate respect for all people of all cultures? Does their intellectual foundation justify their respect? Postmodern tribalism assumes cultural determinism. It's one of the negatives. Because postmodern tribalism believes that our perception of time, ethics, the sacred, death, and a whole host of other things always comes through the filter of culture. In stronger terms, if culture determines our perceptions of reality, we cannot possibly perceive reality in any other way. But when we look at the broad divergence in cultural ideas and practices, then the implication would be that one culture wouldn't be able to communicate with another culture. And yet, we know this isn't true. Another thing is that postmodern tribalism relativizes tribes while absolutizing my tribe. And I think my description here, or the description here, might make that a little clearer than how they call it. Even if postmodern tribalism could communicate ideas across tribal boundaries, it does not offer a common authority to enact an agenda of peaceful coexistence between groups. As Christians, we should find this tragic, as modernism has allowed certain beliefs that they agreed with to subjugate minority voices and shutting them out of the power structures. As Christians, only God has authority, not cultural truths, cultural norms, traditions, or customs. What's more, Christians have often felt marginalized under the assumptions of modernism, as when modernism declared that a religion of divine revelation had no business in universities and valued science and reason for that. Well, the thing is postmodern tribalism rejected universal reason as authority and replaced it with one's own tribal norms and customs. So, my authority is that of my tribe. My tribe determines what is truly authoritative for me, even if it isn't true or authoritative for those outside my tribe. So what if my tribe's tradition cuts off everybody's left thumb? What happens? Well, as part of this tribe, I don't have the authority to determine it's wrong. And since it's my tribe's truth, another tribe has no authority over my tribe to say, that's really stupid, that's wrong. It's an example of what happens when one's entire concept is based on tribal tradition and not a transcendent God. Also, postmodern tribalism degenerates into just another power play. Modernism defined our problem as ignorance that could be eliminated by knowing the truth. Postmodern tribalism calls this a smokescreen. It's a smokescreen to conceal the modernism's actual goal of attaining power. Postmodernism wants to rectify the imbalances caused by modernism, but cannot appeal to universal truth. So, how are they going to achieve it? The only way to rectify power arrangements would be power and more power. So, if I'm maximizing the power of my thumb with its own particular truth, no left thumbs, ultimately, what's going to be the difference? How many of you think you'd have tribes fighting for power? Further, postmodern tribalism creates a culture of cult of victimhood. We don't want to belittle legitimate claims of victimization. Rectifying systems and situations that cause harm to people is a fundamental goal of moral behavior. I'd like to insert a little something here. When it comes to moral relativism, what's going to happen to that? We don't want to belittle legitimate claims of victimization. Rectifying systems and situations that cause harm to people is a fundamental goal of moral behavior. What if we don't believe those morals? We talked about that last week. An interesting feature of postmodern tribalism is groups that use their status as victims as means to claim their resources of power. There's no incentive to overcome oppression if that's where one claims their right to power. Come overcome oppression, you don't have power anymore. It's even more difficult because of postmodern's tendency to view victimhood as conferring moral virtue on the oppressed. Also, postmodern tribalism is susceptible to using suffering as a political and social lever without offering a way to eliminate it. So, I don't know about you, but as for me, I think I can see where this is headed. And then another one is postmodern tribalism is culturally reductionistic. It's another one of those big fancy words, I guess. I've already talked about the many factors and components that can make up a race. Race, ethnicity, religion, orientation, gender, economic class. There's many more of them. But postmodern tribalism tends to reduce this to just one facet, reducing a person's identity to that facet. Race, gender, ethnicity, economic class. So if I describe myself as a male, Christian, middle class, Caucasian, of European descent, educated in the Western tradition, retired, a mechanic, a citizen of the United States, which one of those nine tribes do I belong to? Am I supposed to just pick one? None of them are cultural equivalents. Do I pick the one that has the most power? That wouldn't seem to make sense to most people, would it? The reduction of our identity to one factor is completely arbitrary and does not do justice to actual human beings. For me, a closing thought on tribalism. Can you think of a past or current worldly tribal system you would like to live in? Now, ask where you could find a tribe that includes every male, female, race, creed, occupation, ancestry, ethnicity, go on, etc., that would allow them to live, breathe, eat, and work side by side? In love, truth, and grace? Yeah. That tribe's a church that Jesus established 2,000 years ago. We don't usually think of our family here as a tribe, but since it is. So hope is not a method, but at this point I would hope that you realize that postmodernism is unacceptable as a Christian worldview. So, why do we care about worldviews? Why should we care about worldviews? Well, I'll give you one. Our children. I talked about faith at home before. I emphasize faith at home. Try to emphasize faith at home. Because life showed me how much it matters and the difference it can make. Some of you may have noticed that I don't have much hair and I have gray hair. I've got a couple years under my belt. I could see what happens, okay, personally, when faith at home isn't practiced or done right. So, it's something I felt personally when I look back on my life and see the mistakes I made. You throw a stone into a still pond, and the ripples will dissipate and go away. But one thing you don't do is go to another pond. But for the mistakes we sometimes make, the effects can ripple through generations. Once again, check your First Testament, read about the Israelites, and see how that went for them. It's been said before, I'm going to say it again. Studies have shown that our worldview is set by 12 or 13 years old. I did not know that. In my lifetime, I've seen our culture taking more and more of an anti-Christian and godless worldview. I'm guessing that you sense it as well. It indicates that instead of a biblical Christian worldview, the secular worldviews we've been talking about are winning the hearts and minds of our children. There are different facets to faith at home, but the goal is to establish a Christian worldview in our children. Some naysayers would say it's indoctrination. Well, I would ask, what would you rather have indoctrinated into? They're being indoctrinated now. Children spend 6 to 7 hours a day at school, not including travel or school activities. They have about the same wake hours at home on school days, and they're playing various sports or have other practices after school and on weekends. These secular worldviews may have started with intellectual philosophers that moved into our universities, but as can be seen around us, literally, all over our country, they're moving into our high schools, middle schools, and continuing on down the ladder. We, the congregation, can help in various ways, and we want to. I consider it's very important that our children are here and participating as part of the example we set to not forsake the assembly. But realistically, with only 4 to 6 hours a week here at the church between classes, service, and jaywalkers, what's going to have the most influence? The time they spend in church pales in comparison to the time they spend at school, with friends, coaches, instructors, whatever they see on social media. Proverbs 17:6 says, "Grandchildren are the crowning glory of the aged. Parents are the pride of their children." How do we become the crowning glory or pride of children? Parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles, we must be demonstrating with our lives a biblical Christian worldview. Read the book of Daniel. Consider the faith and example that his parents had to demonstrate at home and develop in Daniel during a time of Judah's apostasy. It's really amazing. So as our nation sinks deeper and deeper into an anti-Christian, anti-God society, the training of our children is going to be critical. So there's more about why we should care about worldviews. From the time we're born, without realizing it, we're assimilating these secular worldviews from the people and culture around us. We don't even realize it. Without these worldviews being discussed in our introspection, we have no awareness of what's influencing us on a deep and hidden level. Individualism, consumerism, nationalism, scientific materialism, moral relativity, postmodern tribalism, once we've gone over so far, there's a couple more to do. The worldview of our culture is a pattern of which Paul says, we've been reading this, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will." It's not a question if we have a pure biblical Christian worldview. We don't. It's a question of how much of the secular worldview we've absorbed and how much of it has to be overcome for us to be transformed. I do not think that we can sugarcoat what's happening in our society. Just a few minutes of TV, walking through a store should be enough. Spending time in the First Testament, reflecting on the story of the Israelites, as I've mentioned, and how many times they failed because they didn't follow God's ways. Didn't use God's worldview. The more I read the book Hidden Worldviews, the more I was able to see some of myself in these secular worldviews, but also understand how a particular worldview could draw someone in. As the authors pointed out, there are good aspects to each one of these worldviews. I say these worldviews, like any good lie, has a kernel of truth. The problem is that each of these secular worldviews kicks God off the throne and are dealing with salvation by man. The true salvation we all need, everybody needs, is through Jesus the Christ. But as in Proverbs 16:25, unfortunately, there is a way that seems right to a man and it leads to death. You can bring that team up. I realized when reading the book that the reason I was troubled and am having trouble understanding what is happening in our society is because we're not talking the same language. Raised under modernism, my base of reality is a scientific method, logic, and universal or absolute truth, which isn't going to speak to people when their base of reality is emotion, feelings, and my truth is truth. We might speak the English language, but the same words do not mean the same thing. Yet I believe there is hope. It's not a pleasant thought for a guy who likes things as they were. I think in 20 years I may not actually recognize the country that I knew as I grew up. But the more cultural changes around us, the As we see this continued decline in morality and an increasingly anti-God, anti-Christian culture, the more Christians can stand out in the culture. The more we'll be that light in the darkness that we're supposed to be. But, and yes, there's a condition. Children, as Christians, should and must have adopted a biblical Christian worldview in both word and deed, including at home, to be that light to hope for the world. I hope that these past six lessons are meaningful and beneficial to you, that they're opening your eyes and ears, mind and heart, to the ways worldviews are shaping and forming you, and allowing you to see our culture a little more clearly with a better understanding. Okay? Thank you.
Let's stand together.